For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Martyrs and Missionaries is a production of Revive Studios. You're listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise, and in every episode, I'll bring you a new martyr and or missionary, the called and the brave. In this episode, we're covering the life of John Hunt, missionary to the cannibals of Fiji. So I want to give you a little bit of background on Fiji just to give you an idea of what it's like, where it is, that sort of thing. So it is an island country in the South Pacific, about 1,700 miles north of New Zealand. It has over 300 islands, but only about 100 of those are inhabited. And now most people live on the two major islands, Vanua Levi and Vitu Levi. Fiji became a British colony in 1874 after a chief ceded it in order to pay off his debts, and it remained a British colony until 1970 and is now a parliamentary democracy with close ties to Britain. In fact, so close that some Fijians actually still choose to serve in the British military. The main religion in Fiji is Christianity at 64%, 28% are Hindu, and 6% are Muslim. These last two groups are not necessarily indigenous Fijians, but those who were actually brought over from other places during the slave trade. And it is known today as a tropical paradise and the bobblers of very expensive water, but less than 200 years ago, they were known as the Cannibal Isles. So what changed? And as you know, missionaries, and namely one man in particular, John Hunt, whom we are covering today. If you look at the life of John Hunt, it's a very short one. He only lives for 36 years, but in his short life, he learned multiple languages, and he worked to translate the New Testament into the Fijian language directly from the Greek and then interspersed with Fijian idioms to maximize understanding. But what may surprise you is that he was born in England to illiterate parents. So for much of his youth, he had almost none of the qualities that he would come to be known for. He wasn't thought of as particularly bright. He was only mildly interested in religion, and he spent most of his time working on the farm. Not even his own farm. He was working for someone else, although he did go to the local school where he learned how to read and write. It wasn't until he was 16 years old and feared he was dying from a brain fever where his life trajectory was changed. He barely survived, and so he decided to go to the Methodist chapel, and he felt convicted, but he still wasn't quite ready to make a decision. He attended a meeting, and then he asked for the fellow attendees there to pray for him, to have wisdom and guidance, and then later on, he went to a sermon with some of those same people to hear a well-known preacher in his day, someone whose name we've forgotten now, but I'll read his conversion from his biography here. The sermon, he says, was plain, pointed, and powerful, and some parts of it were awful, but the main effect on my mind was rather hardening than otherwise. He stayed at the prayer meeting, but still seemed unmoved. His party of friends had set out homewards, but Hunt proposed to return again to the chapel. The preacher was praying by the side of a poor woman, "Send us more power." John was moved to say amen, and in a moment he himself was broken down and prayed in an agony. Before he had left the place, he had found conscious salvation. And it was from that moment forward that he was interested in spiritual and intellectual improvement, because he'd had a very basic education, but it honestly wasn't much of one at all. And so he was actually able to utilize his employer's library in order to read all sorts of books in the spare moments he wasn't working or spending in prayer. And he also started going to night school, and he prayed that the Lord would direct him to be a minister. That's what he wanted to do. And God answered his prayer rather quickly, because one evening, while in church, it turned out that there was no preacher that was going to be coming that night, and so John was asked to give an address, and word spread that many felt the Lord had blessed him with the gift of preaching, and before long, he was in high demand as a circuit preacher, And so people from everywhere in his local area of Lincolnshire loved his preaching, the straightforwardness of it, and his passionate earnestness for souls. And John later wrote the reason for his success. "I see, to be useful as a public speaker, I must be eminent as a private Christian." Reverend William Smith, who was the head of his circuit, wanted to give John a larger reach and recommended him for ministry at a quarterly meeting in 1835. And he was accepted unanimously and was approved to begin his studies at a seminary in London. Now, there was a missionary who was on furlough from South Africa, and then he had been on redeputation because he had been off the field for a number of years, needed to come back, and he was able to hear John speak, and then they struck up kind of a conversation, and John had this new ambition that he wanted to return with this missionary to South Africa as his servant to do some gardening and some farm work, to teach in the Sunday school, and to preach to the English settlers. So then he shifts the focus of his studies towards what would be profitable for foreign ministry in South Africa. And he felt blessed to have so many wonderful professors to learn from at the seminary, and he worked just as hard to learn everything as he could from them. And at times he felt overwhelmed and said, "I may not be able to do much, but I can plod." So while at seminary, he determined to keep a diary, and he wrote his first entry November 14th, 1836, "I now, in the fear of God, commence keeping a diary. I think it will be of use to me, as this is a very important period of my life. I have no doubt that what I may write will be useful to me in future days." And it wasn't only useful to him, but also to his future biographies. One of those biographies writes, "The true life of a man will be found in his letters and diaries. Like a flower preserved in its color and freshness and fragrance, they show us the true inwardness of things." A few years later, in February of 1838, two missionaries from Fiji came back to England, and they told these horrific tales of the cannibalism and wife strangling that was going on over there. And so in response, the Wesleyan Mission House asked John to join their Fiji mission alongside a few other men. So John went home to think about it and pray about it, but he was also worried that his longtime sweetheart, Hannah Summers, would say no, because she was prepared to go with him to South Africa. But would she feel the same way about a bunch of cannibal islands in the far-flung South Pacific? So we don't have her exact response to that, but we do have the ultimate answer, which was yes. They get married less than a month later. And then they and their team set out for Fiji in April, arriving in Australia in August, and they spend 2 months there before heading out in October alongside John Williams, who was headed to what is now Vanuatu. And his name may sound familiar to you because he's actually cropped up more than a few times in previous episodes, most prominently in the story of John G. Peyton, because he will be killed and cannibalized almost 1 year later to the date. But John Hunt and the rest of the Fiji mission arrived in the Rewa province, where they will be stationed in December of 1838. And it's kind of crazy to think that all of this happened in less than a year's time, which is so different from missions today, where it often takes just years and years to get missionaries to the field. They had two veteran missionaries who were already working there in Rewa for about 3 years. These were Reverends David Cargill and William Cross. And a few months before they landed in Fiji, an interesting thing occurred, what you could say a thing of providence, that would work to keep all future missionaries safe from cannibalism. So an English ship had gone too close to the island and then was overwhelmed and burned by natives, and its crew included two missionaries who were dressed up in religious garb, and they were all cooked and eaten. And everyone who took part in that particular feast died, and then many others contracted the Black Plague, which spread far and wide. So the priests gathered the people together and explained to them that they had killed the priests of the white man's god, and he was angry with them. So they could still kill and eat white men, but they weren't allowed to touch the priests. Now, of course, Cargill and Cross left for Fiji, and they had no idea about any of this. So later, when they asked if they were afraid of being killed, Cargill said, "No, because we died before we went," which you would have to have, because you had no idea that you would actually be totally safe from cannibalism. So that's a pretty cool story. That's a really providential story. So to paint another picture of Fiji for you, it is home to the largest soft coral reef in the world, and the missionaries who were sailing into the islands were in awe of its beauty as they sailed into harbor. And one of the wives wrote, "When the tide is low and the sea without a ripple, you float idly over the coral beds, suffering your boat to lie at rest or drift with the current as a stroke of the oars will disturb the clear surface of the water beneath which lay such inexhaustible stores of loveliness. Every sort and kind of coral grow there together, and from the outstretched branches which looked like golden shrubs to the great tables of solid coral, on which lie strewn shells and sponges and heaps of brain and mushroom corals. These living shrubs assume every shade of color. Some are delicate pink or blue, others of a brilliant mauve, some pale primrose. So I say this to paint a picture of what it looks like at the sea and then what it looks like on the actual islands themselves. So Fijians lived in comfortable houses in towns, and their society was divided up into guilds. They were divided into potters and farmers and fishermen and carpenters and priests, and they had no written language, but their history was recorded in songs and chants. So mythologies, legends, and proverbs could all be recited at great length by any one of the priests when the need arose. And as John was studying their language, he found that the cause of their obscene amounts of cannibalism was inherently religious. So the bodies of their fallen enemies were brought up to the temple and then offered as a sacrifice to the gods. They were not cooked in normal pots, but actually in special ovens designed specifically for the purpose of ritualistic cannibalism. And they kept a record of how many bodies had been sacrificed in the temples and later consumed. And the greatest insult or revenge you could give to an enemy was to kill him, cook him, and then leave him to bake away in the oven without consuming him. Cannibalism was never practiced out of lack of food, but the routine consumption of human flesh created a kind of hungering for it. Warriors were said to be hungering to eat their foes. And like other similar cultures, they believed that eating their victims would grant them their bravery and strength, etc. King Takumbao, whose name you will hear again, said that by the time he was 50, he had probably consumed portions of at least 1,000 sacrifices. So it's this mission field that 26-year-old John Hunt and his new wife found themselves in. About a month after he'd arrived in Rewa, he got his first chance to preach, and everyone was listening politely because culturally it was considered extremely rude to smile or point out a grammatical or pronunciation error, so he had absolutely no idea how well he actually did or if anything was even understood. But as he continued studying and talking with people, and he ended up progressing quite nicely, and he enjoyed speaking and writing the idioms of the Fijian language, and as a result was granted the position of chief editor for their biblical translation work. So they were working on the New Testament first, and then he was actually translating it directly from the Greek instead of an English translation, and then when he finished a section, he would send it off to a native editor who would then make sure that it flowed well. But the translation was slow going because there are just so many words for which the Fijians had zero context. For example, I mean, what are justification and faith into a cannibal? They don't exist. There's no context for that. Hunt's biographer writes, "The Bible from the beginning was the lever which Hunt believed would be honored of God as a means of conversion and the moral uplifting of the people. The Fijians needed the Bible as an authoritative standard of appeal in all questions of conduct and character. Conscience was perverted and called evil good and good evil. The moral sense needed to be corrected by a sure standard. To appeal to the conscience of a Fijian was like appealing for the correct time to a watch with the mainspring broken." So the Ten Commandments became the guidepost through which to teach them. What did it say about a specific conduct? Parables were translated and added to music, as was the Fijian way of remembering a story. The Good Samaritan was one of the first and most successful. Later, many Fijians credited the early steps of their salvation with using the New Testament to learn to read and write. And as they spelled out the letters, the Lord spelled out conviction on their souls. Hunt's finished translation product was a paraphrased and idiomatic format, and it was this first work which allowed Fijians to have a more complete understanding of the more literal translations which would come later.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, learning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
About 6 or 7 months after he had arrived in Rewa, John was told that he was to be reassigned with another missionary to a different island, to the city of Somosomo, which is about a 1-hour flight north of Rewa. But in those days, it was a lot longer than that, so not a particularly close island. The chief there had requested missionaries, so they were obligated to go. And while John was very sad to leave the infant church there on Rewa, he writes, "But the difficulty of leaving Rewa and going to Somosomo affected us only as mortals. As missionaries, we thought nothing of the privations or trials we might have to endure. We expect to sow in tears as confidently as we hope to reap in joy. And therefore, trials and privations are words seldom used by us, and things that are thought of much more by our friends at home than by us." When they arrived in Somosomo, the people were indifferent to their arrival, but the chief was really pleased to see them and set them up in a temporary home while the mission house was being built. And the next day, their wives and all the rest of their belongings arrived by boats, piloted by English sailors, armed to the teeth and bristling with nerves, because while the missionaries may have been safe from being snacked on, the sailors were not. So they didn't go ashore, nor did they get too close to the canoes, which the natives were using to ferry the missionaries' goods to land. The beginning of the missionaries' time in Somosomo starts off rather traumatic. So heaven for the Fijians was described as a little island to the west of them, and you could see it as the sun set. It was really beautiful. Fijian religion held that a goddess lived there whose job it was to club every bachelor who arrived at the island. So only a married man was permitted to enter. And when a chief died, his widows were strangled to accompany him. And the minimum needed was 5, but often polygamous chiefs had many more than 5, and so all of them were strangled because it was considered disgraceful for a living widow to be around after the chief had died. So the bodies of the widows served as carpets and cushions for the dead chief. The missionaries had not been in Somosomo for long before the news of a shipwreck reached them. The king's son and many others had been drowned in an accident, and it was decided that 16 women would be chosen to accompany him in death. Hunt records the following scene in his journal. "On the morning of the 8th, we heard the cries of the poor women and their friends, and soon they were mercilessly strangled. We were obliged to be in the midst of it, and truly their cries and wailings were awful. Soon after they were murdered, they were brought to be buried about 20 yards from our house. Our minds were kept in peace during these scenes. Our hearts were affected, of course, but God preserved us from fear. The wild wailing was the preliminary of the strangling. It was the farewell of the relatives and friends of those who were leaving. The actual strangling was done in solemn silence, with a sheet of native cloth thrown over the victim. John's wife Hannah could not take the stress of the event and came near to death. John was contemplating what life on the field would be like without her, and many others gathered around her to pray that she might be spared. And these prayers were answered, and she recovered from the brink of death, and her recovery was considered to be a miracle by everyone there who witnessed it. In other aspects of the ministry, little progress was being made. The chief was given to fits of rage. He refused to settle on a site for the mission house. They were forced to live right by the temple and hear, and I imagine smell, all the terrible things that were happening there. They were refused even to put a screen door up to shield their eyes from it. And then further trials came when John and Hannah's firstborn child came along, but only lived for 12 days and had to be buried among cannibals. Tribal warring and cannibal feasts became a more and more regular occurrence. John writes, "In our work, we seem to labor in vain, but faith can never come to such a conclusion. I would not believe such a thing if all the philosophers in the world were to tell me so. If we preach Christ's truth, he is with us, and his presence is not in vain. I love these poor wretches, obstinate as they are." Even more disappointment awaited them when they realized that even the few friends they had and potential converts they had would have killed them in a moment's notice. So they were coming back to the island from a local voyage, and they were almost shipwrecked upon the reefs. And the locals were hooping and wailing for joy at the potential feast because their religion decreed that anyone who had water in their eyes or was a survivor of a shipwreck had to die. Some of the most jubilant shouts came from those who were diligently attending the mission meetings. So 3 years go by much like this with little success. However, they had one nugget of success, and this gives you an idea of exactly what they were dealing with. So newly minted war canoes were baptized into the sea using human rollers. These were prisoners of war, which the ship would be rolled over, crushing them to death on its way to the sea. And then these bodies would be cooked and eaten as a symbol of thanks to the gods and a hope that they would be granted fair winds and safe voyages. The missionaries were able to plead with the lives of these prisoners, and these chiefs allowed the boat to be rolled into the water without the prisoners, and nothing ill befell the boat or the citizenry. Despite all these things going on around them, John forced himself to find the positives of a society such as the Fijians. He discovered their work ethic, irrigation systems, knowledge of construction, papermaking, gardens, and their depth of knowledge regarding the human world to be a positive light in such a bleak place. So finding the positives was an essential practice that allowed him not to become overwhelmed by everything around him and also not to become bitter, which would have destroyed any fruit, no matter how small. And then with this knowledge, he also gained a better insight into how he could continue the translation work with even more accuracy, capturing and translating key elements for better understanding. About this time, Reverend Cross, who was one of the first missionaries there in Fiji, becomes sick, and he needs the medical care that only John's partner, Somo Somo, can provide. And John goes to Viva Island, which is about 2 miles from Bau, which is the capital of Fiji at the time. And the very first stone house in Fiji was built to house the printing press, which John would use, and his house was generously constructed by other foreigners on the island from the lumber of 2 wrecked ships. And apparently it still creaked with every gust of wind, just as it would at sea, giving John and his wife the impression that they might just be at sea, actually, which sounds kind of cool, but also a little annoying. And it is possible about this time that they had at least one child, but I couldn't find any dates on birth or actually gender even. But they will eventually have 4 children, only 2 of whom would survive infancy. Reverend Cross had been at Viwa Island for 3 years and had experienced quite a fruitful ministry, so he left John with a flourishing church, and many of them were young men whose powerful testimonies and continued growth proved their conversions. Their growth rate was so rapid that John realized they would actually need to raise up these young men to be Bible teachers and send them out. So he started a small theology school of sorts using notes he compiled from his years in the seminary alongside the Bible, and then prepared these young men for ministry. And eventually some of them would go far beyond Fiji to New Zealand, Samoa, and Tonga. Church services often became the sources of great spiritual expression. People would come to church eagerly and would be singing and shouting, often fainting and being dragged out of the chapel so that they were not a distraction. And when they came to, they would exhort the other believers and join them in prayer. John writes, "It is not wonderful to us that such people should be affected in such a manner when we consider what dreadful cannibals, murderers, polygamists many of them were only a few months since. Who can be surprised that a proper view of themselves should produce such an effect on their minds? When we saw their agonies and heard their wailings, it frequently appeared to us as the most consistent thing we had ever seen. Suppose 20 men should murder 100 of their neighbors and eat them, or divide them among their friends to be eaten. Suppose they afterwards attend the ministry of the gospel and are convinced of the desperate need of wickedness of the kind of deed they had committed. Who would believe they were truly convinced of the awful nature and consequences of such a sin if they merely shed tears or manifested their contrition in an ordinary way? We should say, nay, these men cannot be truly penitent, for true repentance consists in having a proper knowledge of our sins and corresponding feelings." On another island where a church service was underway, a band of 30 young chiefs came together to put a stop to it. Some of their future wives were in the meetings, and they just couldn't have that, so they marched around the church with clubs, shouting death to the participants to tell them to come out. Eventually, they decided to break into the church and fell down one by one into convulsions, saying they could feel the hellfire burning in their veins. The Christians gathered around to pray for them all through the night until every single one of the men who had entered the church came out as believers. In addition to discipleship, preaching, and teaching, John was hard at work on translating the rest of the scriptures. They had just finished the New Testament. It was being printed and delivered, and they had hoped to finish the Old Testament in the next 5 to 6 years. And about this work, he writes, "These things are little thought of by our friends at home. They know something of that part of our work which consists in visiting various places, preaching the gospel, teaching schools. But they know very little of what is done in the study, what hours of anxious thought spent in deciding the meaning of words and phrases, and how the word of God is to be put into the language of the people without altering its meaning or making it difficult for them to understand. A pale face, a feverish state of the body, a mind almost distracted, and an appetite perhaps impaired indicate that something severe has been going on behind the scenes." Later on, John became regional director, and he had to make many trips far from base and visit the work going on there. And these were sometimes 100-mile journeys that were taken on these frail canoes where you couldn't sleep, because if you slept, then the captain would lash himself to the steering and he'd go to sleep too, and many canoes were crashed doing this. These visits involved a lot more than just preaching, so he had to provide an educational analysis of all the day schools for the children, interview those who were eligible for baptism, and annul polygamous marriages. And I'll actually explain this a little bit further, because annulling polygamous marriages, or how that kind of works in a society, has been something that you hear actually quite frequently in Christian circles. How would you deal with this? So this is how they dealt with it. So only the first wife of a polygamist convert was kept, and the wives were able to remarry, many quickly finding a suitable match. Female infanticide was high, and so many of the men had no women to marry when they came of age, because the polygamist system dwindled the already smaller dating pool. So the chief, who was now a Christian and all of his previous marriages had been annulled, he was actually given the option of vetoing a marriage of one of his previous spouses, if he thought that they couldn't provide for his wife or his children, and he also had the option of taking his children into his home to provide for them himself. And also marriages where the wife had been taken by force as a child were not recognized. So that was their way of dealing with it. In June of 1848, John was requested to serve as an interpreter for a British captain visiting several islands. And while journeying with the captain, he contracted dysentery. And he had moments of improvement followed by moments of sharp decline. When he was feeling better, he visited the day schools. And as he neared the end, he preached his very last sermon at the mission house. And from his deathbed, he prayed continuously for the Fijians, and specifically for the salvation of Chief Takombau, the man who thought that he had consumed portions of 1,000 people in his lifetime. In his last moments, he turned to his wife Hannah and said, "I have had a fresh manifestation of the love of God. I bless the Lord. I see nothing but Jesus. He is my joy. I thought I should have entered heaven singing Jesus and salvation. Now I shall enter singing Jesus, salvation, and glory, eternal glory, hallelujah," he repeated 20 or 30 times, every time fainter, till his voice was hushed. And with that, he died on October 4th, 1838, at the age of 36, after 10 years of work in Fiji. His biographer notes that he had crowded the work of a long life into 10 short years. His wife Hannah left Fiji with their two children the following year, broken down in health and seemingly in spirit. She came back to England, but both of her parents had since died. She proofed the translation work of her husband and provided a finished copy to the British and Foreign Bible Societies. She never regained her full health and continued to live a quiet life until she died about 40 years later. Chief Takombau reflected on his last visit with John. "I was first favorably impressed towards the Christian religion when I saw it made dying not only easy, but triumphant." John had also written a private letter to the chief expressing his love for him and a prayer. Takombau came to Christ shortly thereafter, and the crowd at his baptism included the widows of husbands he had killed, relatives of men he had eaten, and adult children who had formerly vowed vengeance against Takombau for the deaths of their fathers. Since then, they had all become Christians. Reverend John Watsford, who was the lone survivor of that early pioneer mission to Fiji, in 1881 he gave an address at a conference in Australia, and he gives a moving tribute to John, and I'll read just a section of it. "When he was ill and it was feared he would die, the distress of everyone was very great. I was at the special prayer meeting held in Viwa to pray for his recovery, and I heard that wonderful prayer by Virani, one of the earliest Christian chiefs. Telling the Lord what his servant had done, he cried, 'If someone must go, Lord, take me, but spare thy servant. If one will not do, take 10. If 10 are not enough, take 20. Only spare thy servant to do thy work in Fiji.' Virani's prayer was not answered. Mr. Hunt died most triumphantly, died praying for Fiji, and his prayer has been answered. For today, heathenism in Fiji is a thing of the past. As always, thank you for listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.